Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Expectations as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits Nigeria today, Thursday.
It's an opportunity to strengthen ties with Nigeria as the world continues to open. Africa has been lagging behind in being able to access the vaccine, and I hope that that will be top of the agenda, as well as issues of security.
We'll also talk with an expert about Secretary Blinken's upcoming visit to Senegal. Nairobi's Situation Room is to help African countries respond to disasters. A Pretoria High Court says 8 years of former President Jacob Zuma's taxes should be made public. And more violence by security forces at Wednesday's pro-democracy protest in Sudan.
They use tear gas, and there are also reports of using arms and ammunition. And Wednesday, according to the Sudanese doctors, 10 young people lost their lives, and more than 70 got injured.
And Zimbabwe doctors warn against complacency as COVID-19 infections decline. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrives in Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, today, Thursday, as part of a three-nation trip that includes Kenya and Senegal. Blinken is expected to discuss the COVID-19 pandemic, climate change, revitalizing democracies, and security issues. Ahead of his visit, Nigerian experts weighed in on the issues and their expectations. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will meet in Abuja with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari and other top government officials, including the Vice President and Foreign Affairs Minister. They will discuss cooperation on global health security, expanding energy access and economic growth, and revitalizing democracy, according to a U.S. State Department release last week. Political analyst and co-founder of Youth Hub Africa, Rotimi Olawale, describes Blinken's visit as timely, especially as many African nations, including Nigeria, have failed to meet targets set by the World Health Organization for vaccinating the public.
It's an opportunity to strengthen ties with Nigeria as the world continues to open. Africa has been lagging behind in being able to access the vaccine, and I hope that that will be top of the agenda, as well as issues on security and support to ensure that the shrinking civil space, not only in Nigeria but across the region, is also addressed.
Nigeria is battling a range of security threats, including the Boko Haram insurgency, intercommunal clashes, and more recently, a wave of mass abductions at schools. The West African country has also been named among countries with shrinking civil space, worsened by issues of police brutality that triggered mass protests last year and crackdowns on free speech and the media. While in Abuja, Blinken is expected to talk about U.S.-Africa policy, emphasizing the value of democracy. This year alone, the continent has witnessed 4 successful military coups, threatening decades of progress toward democracy, says Olawale.
There's also democratic challenges across West Africa, actually also across the continent. Where in the last couple of months, we have seen a number of coups in Chad, in Guinea, in Sudan, and in several other countries where there's been a challenge to democracy. It's important as Nigeria plays a stabilization role across West Africa and across the continent that this is also top of the agenda.
President Joe Biden took office in January, aiming to bolster ties with Africa, shaken by his predecessor, Donald Trump. Shortly after his inauguration, Biden signed an executive order lifting travel bans imposed by Trump on Muslim countries, including Nigeria, a move that was widely praised. Still, Nigerian security analyst Senator Irebu says major improvements in Africa policy under the Biden administration have been slow.
Yes, there was an initial attempt at the beginning of the Biden administration to show that the U.S.-Africa relation will be different. A lot of people, policymakers in Africa, are yet to understand the trajectory the Biden administration is taking when it comes to U.S.-Africa policy. A lot of it is shrouded in secrecy.
These experts hope the Biden administration's plans regarding Africa become much clearer by the time Blinken ends his visit. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrives in Senegal today, Thursday, as part of his first tour of Africa since the Biden administration took office. U.S.-Senegal relations expert Alpha Bodian spoke to Ricky Stryak about his concerns, such as security and offshore oil in Senegal.
The relations have been consolidated and have been evolving positively, that we can say. Even if we tap our memories, everybody remembers President Diouf's visit to in Washington, and people had a little problem because President Abdou Diouf, being very told, they were just racking their brain to find the possibility to give him a bed, which would be as large and as long as the president was. So these are anecdotes we can tell. We also remember the visit of President Bill Clinton and, of course, the visit of Barack Obama. So these have been consolidating the relations between the United States and Senegal. And, you know, Senegal got the Millennium Challenge account from the American administration, and USAID is still around.
Do you think, though, that given the recent years of destabilization in the Sahel, that the relationship between the U.S. and Senegal has become, the militaries of the two countries have become more intertwined?
What I can say from a military perspective is that for some time, senior officers in the Senegalese army have had the possibility to go and get further trained at West Point. I also know that American military can be seen around here doing some sort of practice and collaborating with their Senegalese counterpart. You don't have a massive presence of American militaries, but they certainly are around here and work with the Senegalese counterpart in terms of drills.
If one were to say the relationship is one that is mutually beneficial, what would Senegal's benefit be from its relationship with U.S. And vice versa?
I don't know if the relationship or the exchanges are balanced, but I know that Senegal had the opportunity, which was offered by an initiative taken by President Bill Clinton called AGOA, Africa Growth Opportunity Act, and which stated that much as goods from the United States could be commercialized in Senegal, Senegal also had the opportunity to export and commercialize goods. But I know that the United States Department of Agriculture is very, very strict as to farming goods which are authorized to just be commercialized in the United States. But that was an opportunity. This MCA Millennium Challenge account also is an opportunity which Senegal is taking advantage of. And Senegal is not, there are not many countries on the continent taking advantage of those opportunities. The second phase of this MCA is going to help Senegal further electrify the remotest part of a country. This is no small thing.
That was U.S.-Senegal relations expert Alpha Bodian. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Pro-democracy protesters say Sudanese security forces used tear gas and live bullets during Wednesday's protest, demanding the military return the country's democratic transition to civilian control. Journalist Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital Khartoum says as many as 10 demonstrators were killed during Wednesday's protest.
James, Wednesday's protest is a series of the protests that have been going on since 25th of October. The last two protests have been faced with a lot of excessive force from the police. They used tear gas, and there are also reports of using arms and ammunition against the protesters. Last Saturday, 6 were killed. And Wednesday, according to the Sudanese doctors, 10 young people lost their lives and more than 70 got injured who have been taken to the hospital for treatment. And around noontime on Wednesday as well, the Sudanese government decided to shut down the telecommunications. No phone calls can be made. We only receive international calls. And they also ordered the internet providers for private companies and all to also shut down.
As you mentioned, Michael, once this protest is a continuation, are there new demands that the protesters are making? What are their main concerns now?
The protesters wanted a civilian government. That is the main force behind their protest. They wanted the partnership between the military and civilian to come to an end. They wanted the military to hand over this transitional period to a civilian government. They wanted the military to restore the internet back. They wanted the military to release all the political detainees who have been detained since October last month. If we can list them, they have more than 10 demands that are currently on the table to the military officials in Sudan. They don't want to recognize the current transitional sovereignty council that has been formed by Al-Burhan. They don't want to even recognize Burhan himself, accusing him of violating the constitutional document that is supposed to rule the transitional period.
In the past few days, there have been reports about prisoners' release in Sudan. What do you know about that?
So far, there have been an effort by mediators, especially mediation from the South Sudan government. So this effort have ended only by releasing four ministers who were actually, according to the military, they were put only custody due to security matters. So these are the only political detainees that have been released. The remaining detainees are still in as we speak. According to military sources, some of them are actually going to be charged in the court of law. Even the charges are not yet made public, but they are still in the custody, waiting maybe for the charges to put against them in the court of law. And these are some of the political figures that Prime Minister Hamdok has put for the military as a condition for his reinstatement as a prime minister. He wanted these individuals to be released without charges so that he can accept to come as a prime minister again.
Michael, thank you so much. We are always very happy to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James. My pleasure.
That was journalist Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 18. On Wednesday this week, the High Court in Pretoria, South Africa, ruled that 8 years of former President Jacob Zuma's individual tax returns be given to the Financial Mail and the Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism. Cherise Takor is the advocacy coordinator at the Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism.
What happened in the circumstances was that there was allegations that were revealed in a very popular book by investigative journalist Jacques Poe called The President's Keepers, which actually alluded to instances where former President Zuma had failed to comply with tax laws. And some of this evidence was corroborated in other documents and more formal filings. So there was really a strong indication that there was, you know, tax malfeasance by the sitting president. And that was the public interest hook in obtaining these tax records.
Now, what do you think this means for South Africa going forward for officials of government?
Well, again, this won't affect, you know, the average government official who maybe doesn't disclose fully on their tax returns or, you know, fails to clear some type of income. That's not what will be implicated here. Really, there's a legal test that's set out in Section 46 of our Access to Information Law, which sets quite a stringent standard. And this is not just in relation to tax matters. It's a public interest override, which can be used to kind of overcome situations where there's grounds for refusal. But basically, what this public interest override says is that where there's, you know, a compelling public interest and there's certain legal, you know, tests that you need to, or hurdles that you need to overcome, like, for instance, showing that there's an imminent threat to safety, or there's a contravention of a law. And then there's also the balancing at the end, which is where the public's interest or the relevance of the information to the public interest must outweigh the harm caused to the individual, you know, whose, for instance, in this case, privacy is impinged upon. So going forward, it's not going to be the case where everybody's tax records or a large proportion of people's tax records are made available willy-nilly, but really where there's a real public interest, where, for instance, you know, the head of state is an extremely powerful figure and someone who is absolutely beholden to the laws of the country, you know, it is in the public's interest to know if he was not complying with those laws.
Is it likely that this revelation may add or maybe subtract from the troubles that the former president, Jacob Zuma, already is facing? Is it likely that more information might come out of this?
Certainly. I think there's, you know, the state capture years, which unfortunately happened under his watch to a large extent, you know, really had a very huge impact on South Africa and where we are now. So there is, even though he's no longer president, the public is interested in knowing what exactly happened in those years. And part of the allegations that I referred to was that he had instituted or placed Tom Moyane into a position of power at the Revenue Service in order to, as the head of the Revenue Service, basically, in order to conceal the supposed alleged tax malfeasance. And under Tom Moyane's watch, you know, the Revenue Service was really undermined and its ability to actually collect revenue was severely impacted. And as the public, we feel those effects to this day.
Charisse, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much, James.
Charisse Takor is the Advocacy Coordinator at the Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism in South Africa. With the earth becoming warmer and weather events more extreme, the African Union has set up a disaster operation center in Nairobi to help monitor major hazards and provide regional early warning for drought, floods, extreme rainfall, food insecurity, and pests like the desert locust. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Major hazards have become more common in Africa and show how vulnerable the continent is to climate change, even though it is the lowest producer of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. To cope with such disasters, the Africa Union has set up a centralized monitoring and early warning system for the continent. The Nairobi Disaster Operations Center for the East African region is the continent's first weather situation room. Julie Ouma is a geographic information system analyst at the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, in Nairobi.
Council of the ministers with the member states sat and said, we need to have a disaster operation center based in Nairobi, which will focus mainly on early warning systems. So that gave birth to establishment in this office, so that we look at a broader aspect of different disasters within the region.
The center, located at the IGAD Climate Prediction and Application Center, uses the East Africa Hazards Watch, a system developed by the center for collecting and sharing multi-hazard data with member countries, as Ouma explains.
The system works automatically so that it ingests in the data set. Algorithm is set within the cluster. We have a supercomputing system within ICPAC. So there's less human attachment to it. It's also near real time, so it's every 10 days to update itself and we see the conditions of drought.
The center provides climate information and early warnings to 11 East African countries. Officials say local communities must be ready to respond quickly to save lives and minimize damage. Amjad Abashar is the regional director for Africa at the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction.
So we must equip the communities themselves to be able to to respond to a disaster in its first hours at least. And so I think we owe it to them to set up this early warning system and ensure that it's functional and that people who are vulnerable to disasters are able to access that information in a timely way to save lives and property.
The Situation Room in Nairobi covers and reports on drought and floods. Another one in Niger, set to be opened this month, will monitor extreme rains and cyclones. The information collected at both sites will be collected and distributed by the Situation Room at the AU headquarters in Addis Ababa. Gatkuoth Kai is the Technical Coordinator for Disaster Risk Reduction at the Africa Union Commission.
We are responding to a very complex situation. Over the years, we have seen disasters increasingly becoming borderless. But even when that hazard is localized, the intensity easily overwhelmed national response. And in this situation, the Pan-African solidarity is required. And therefore, having this Situation Room is going to facilitate that African solidarity.
As Africa experiences more extreme weather, officials say early warnings and early action will help limit its impact. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's government has said the COVID-19 pandemic is under control after days passed with no official deaths and few infections from the virus. But doctors are warning against complacency and say a fresh wave of infections is likely to come. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
After this week's cabinet meeting, Information Minister Monica Mchangwa told journalists that Zimbabwe was managing the COVID-19 situation.
The number of COVID-19 cases in schools is declining. Also, the number of people in need of hospitalization for COVID-19 also decreased, with no patients under intensive care. In general, therefore, this indicates that the national response measures instituted by government continue to pay off and that the pandemic is being brought under control.
Dr. Norman Matara, the head of Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, agrees with the government's assessment.
We do agree that at the present moment, the COVID-19 pandemic has been brought under control. As shown by the figures, you see that the World Health Organization says that a COVID-19 pandemic which is out of control is signified by a positivity rate of more than 5%, and anything below 5% is a well-controlled pandemic. So you see that our positivity rate for the past 3-4 weeks has been less than 2.5%.
Matara warned Zimbabweans to maintain protective measures against the virus.
However, we need to guard against complacency. There is always the danger of another wave coming in, of another new strain coming in, especially when we have not yet achieved herd immunity.
Zimbabwe has fully inoculated just above 2.7 million people since February, when it began its vaccination program to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. The government has a target of vaccinating at least 10 million Zimbabweans, or 60% of the population, by the end of the year. Dr. Clopas Chimbetete, president of Zimbabwe College of Public Health Physicians, says it's not time to relax until that is achieved.
You know, predictions are that we will have a fourth wave. So my advice to the government is that this is time, as the government is doing, to continue to double efforts to make sure that more and more Zimbabweans get vaccinated. Furthermore, this is also time for the government to make sure that we strengthen our case management pillar. As we anticipate that we may get a fourth wave, it's important that we capacitate hospitals across the nation, not just in our major cities and towns.
Carlos Caceres, the International Monetary Fund resident representative in Zimbabwe, says his organization is happy with authorities' swift response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Thursday, November 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day.